Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More and more these days, the person who prepares your tax return, answers your customer service call, writes your software, reads your X-ray, may be not in Idaho or Indiana, but in China or India. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman is back from a deep tour of India with word on how globalization is playing out on the other side of outsourcing. Tonight on Point, Tom Friedman on India, America, your job, and more. But first, American officials are accusing the controversial Iraqi exile and longtime Pentagon favorite, Ahmed Chalabi, of disclosing to Iran that the United States had broken the secret intelligence code of Iran's intelligence service. The alleged disclosure is being described as a major blow to U.S. operations in the Middle East and a major betrayal by a man once backed by Donald Rumsfeld and others to lead post-Saddam Iraq. Bob Drogon has been covering this story for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him what exactly is being alleged.
The story is that Ahmed Chalabi, who has had long ties to the Iranian ruling regime, at some point in the last 6 weeks, revealed to Iranian intelligence that the United States had broken the code that Iran's spy service used to communicate. If it's true, that's an extraordinarily serious breach for U.S. intelligence.
How serious? Why so serious?
Well, on several levels. One is, if it is an encryption system that is the mainstay of the intelligence service, then it would have enabled the United States to be listening in on top secret communications on issues of everything from Iran's covert operations inside of Iraq, its support for Islamic militant groups and alleged terrorism, its nuclear weapons development programs, any number of things might have gone through those channels. And as soon as that is broken, as soon as that is betrayed in this case, then that would have just turned off like a spigot and you lose the access to that. But more broadly, what it does is it puts other countries on notice that the United States has that capability if there was ever a doubt about it. And it may well encourage other countries to say, my God, it's time to update the software.
So this is about as big a breach as it gets. How is Ahmed Chalabi alleged to have come by this information that the United States was monitoring Iranian intelligence communications? And how is he alleged to have passed it on to Iran?
It's a little unclear. One of the published accounts this morning said that an American who was drunk told him. I'm not personally certain how it occurred or at what level it was told to him, that is, in how much detail. What we do know, or what at least the U.S. officials are saying, and there may be a difference there, is that about 6 weeks ago, Dr. Chalabi met with the station chief in Baghdad for Iran's intelligence and security service, and in a conversation with him, told him that the U.S. was monitoring their traffic. That's the allegation. What seems to have happened after that is that the official, who was well known to U.S. intelligence because he's alleged to have run covert operations against U.S. forces, sent a cable, or I believe it's an email in this case, sent a communication back to Tehran. Presumably, he didn't believe that the code had been broken because he sent it back in the same code, which is how the U.S., which was monitoring it, discovered the problem. In response, Tehran then sent another message back that was an attempted sting, if you will, where they said, right, such and such is buried behind the corner grocery at such and such street, or something to that effect.
A weapons cache in Iraq.
Exactly, mm-hmm. To see if U.S. forces would respond. They didn't, because they didn't want to tip their hand. But in any case, it got blown. As source has subsequently been shut down.
Bob, you quote intelligence officials saying this is highly sensitive, highly classified material, the crown jewels of the work that they do, that only a handful of U.S. officials would have the clearance to know that American code breakers had cracked Iran's most secret communications. And you say FBI counter-espionage agents plan to question officials at the Defense Department, I guess, about where this leak might have been, who might have told Ahmed Chalabi, how small a handful, how high in the Pentagon?
This thing is classified at what they call secure compartmented information. That is, it's code word material. It's not just that you have a top secret clearance. You have to be specifically cleared to know that project, you know, Cicada or whatever it's called, involves this. So it's a relatively small number, and whether that's in the dozens or low hundreds, it's not a lot of people in relative terms from start to finish. You know, Dr. Chalabi has come to the United States very often. He has meetings. He's an active member of the Iraqi Council. I'm told that no one at the CIA or at the National Security Agency, which does the monitoring and cracks the codes, is considered as a potential suspect at this point.
Which would put it in the realm of friends in high places, and of course he has friends in very high places. Ahmed Chalabi today saying flat out, this is false, absolutely denying this. But what are you hearing, Bob? What's the level of confidence that this is in fact what happened?
You know, we're in the world here of smoke and mirrors, and the level of confidence that they have versus the level of confidence that I have, there may be some of a difference here, Tom. All I could tell you is that the sources are not backing down on this story. And when I say sources, these are U.S. officials, and unfortunately I can't go any further than that, but
fair
I
enough.
Just got off the phone with one of them. And, you know, they are not backing down. They're saying this is a huge breach. They are very concerned that it got out. They're very concerned that there is more damage that still could be done, which suggests that this is not all that may have been leaked.
Bob, and finally, your newspaper and others have known this for some time and sat on it. Why?
Well, we were told a week or 10 days ago that there was a leak involving intercepted material and not a great deal of detail as to what that entailed. But the government asked us and asked other news organizations not to provide those details because it was an ongoing national security investigation. And in those situations, I mean, I was the one that was approached, and I thought that was a very reasonable concern. I don't have any wish to endanger their forces in the field.
Understood. And why have you come forward now and others? What's changed, Bob?
What happened yesterday was the story began to appear. It began to leak. And when I and others called our original sources on this and said, hey, you know, what's the story here? They said, look, we can't hold you to that promise anymore. You're free to do what you need to do. Once the story is out, you can't reasonably ask people to hold back what they've got.
Bob Drogan, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bob Drogan covers national security for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Check number 665. For $81.55, you will still be hit by the $30 charge. Am I clear?
Is this the only telephone line you have at home?
Go ahead, turn the computer on.
How can I assist you?
And there they are, the voices of young Indians in Bangalore assisting Americans from the other side of the planet. These are jobs that used to be done in the United States but have now been outsourced or offshored to India. To a call center with a night shift studies accent neutralization to flatten their English to sound more American and adopt American-sounding work names. And the 24/7 call centers are just the tip of the iceberg of a visible wave of globalization. Millions of 20-something Indians want their piece of the great Indian dream, says our guest tonight, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman. And the global digital revolution is making that possible. But with what costs and opportunities? Tonight on Point, from call-in centers to IT, weighing the impact of a globalized India for America and the world, with New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. Tom Friedman joins me now from New York. He's a three-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize in 1983, from Lebanon in 1988, from Israel, and again for commentary in 2002. He's the author of the bestsellers From Beirut to Jerusalem, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, and Longitudes and Attitudes, The World in the Age of Terrorism, a collection of his columns post-September 2001. His new documentary, Thomas L. Friedman Reporting, The Other Side of Outsourcing, premieres tomorrow night on the Discovery Channel. Welcome, Tom Friedman.
Great to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. Tom Friedman, you have written lately and often about two struggles that the United States is in the midst of right now. One might be called terrorism or a struggle with Islamist terrorists. The other, a struggle over globalization, over a globalizing economy, and for position in that economy. You've just gone out and spent a lot of time in India. What did you see?
What I saw was a country, Tom, with 555 million people under the age, I believe, of 26. Many of them poor, many of them uneducated or undereducated, but a large chunk of them, and any chunk of 555 million is a chunk, who are called the Zippies. Zippies because they've got a zip in their step. They're educated, they're smart, they speak English, they're hungry, they're competitive. They've really struggled to get into the best Indian IT colleges and from there into the best Indian tech companies. And they have a dream. It's called a Great Indian Dream, and it's a lot like the Great American Dream. And we now live in a world where they can aspire to have it. That's what I found.
Tom, you spent weeks, most of it in Bangalore in the southwest, looking at very closely at Indians in high tech, in call centers. I wish you'd paint a picture for us of the world or worlds there. Americans' picture of India, at least this corner of it, may not be fully up to date. What's it look like? What's it feel like?
To say it's a contrast, Tom, and you've lived in India, you know, is to state the obvious. We have a wonderful scene in the documentary, actually, where I was walking down the sidewalk and there was a water buffalo, a sacred cow, as it were, walking right next to me down the sidewalk. And I came to a stop sign. Of course, I stopped. And the water buffalo just walked right through the traffic to the other side of the road.
They've got priority.
That's right. No, Dodo, this is not Kansas, okay? But, you know, what it looks like in Bangalore, of course, is a town where IT is really at the hot core of the economy. There seem to be technology colleges on every corner. Some of the traffic signs are sponsored by Texas Instruments. When you play golf at the KGA Golf Club in the heart of Bangalore, your playing partner tells you on the first tee that you can either aim at the Microsoft building or the IBM building, both of which are behind the first green. The caddy's wearing a 3M hat, and the tee markers are from Epson. You're in a town that is devoted to really the advancement of high-tech and high-tech jobs from call centers at the bottom to software and real hardcore research and engineering at the top. At the same time, as you walk down the sidewalks in Bangalore, you might, if you're near the Leela Hotel where I stayed in, walk past a building, a high-rise, a modern-looking high-rise that's called the Golden Enclave. I always like that. Every time I walk by it, the Golden Enclave, because in many ways, Bangalore, at least the high-tech sector, is itself a golden enclave surrounded by the most abject poverty I've ever seen. And that's just the working poor of Bangalore. Outside of Bangalore, within 1 hour and 10 millennium, are villages where you really have no flush toilets, no running water, scant electricity, and people who have in many cases never made a phone call.
So, Tom, let's go right to it. Just a couple of weeks ago, India's sitting government, the one that used the phrase India shining, the one that associated itself with all the sleek, high-tech, outsourced work that you're reporting on, was tossed out of government. We'll talk later about what globalization and India are meaning for the United States, but what's it meaning for India if the government that was most closely associated with it got thrown out on its ear?
Well, the Indian election, the thing you got to love about democracy is when you ask people what they think, they tell you. And this Indian election, I think, really is worthy of study because it's a little more complicated than saying that the BJP, the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party, which did use this India shining, really try to take credit for the high-tech revolution in India, got thrown out of power because, as you know, this wasn't just a national election. There were also state elections.
Sure.
And what was really interesting is the Congress Party, which ended up winning at the national level, also got tossed out in key states where it controlled the state government. We say, wait a minute, what's the deal here? I mean, the BJP gets thrown out and the Congress Party? Mm-hmm. And then what does the Congress Party do when it takes power at the national level? Sonia Gandhi, the leader of the Congress Party, says, I'm not going to take over the prime ministership. I want to give it to my party colleague, Mr. Mohan Singh. And who is Mohan Singh? None other than the Deng Xiaoping of India, the man more responsible than any Indian for the high-tech revolution.
Mr. Reform.
He is Mr. Liberalization and Reform, the man who put India on a globalizing track. And he appoints as his finance minister someone in the same mold. So you really have to step back and say, what is going on here?
We're going to look a little more closely at that, Tom. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm talking tonight with three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Tom Friedman. He's just back from a long sojourn in India. He brings us that story. It'll be on Discovery Channel tomorrow night, The Other Side of Outsourcing. We'll look at it right here, right now, what it means for Indians, what it means for Americans. And we'll look at the other struggle, the struggle over terror. Right back with Tom Friedman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times columnist Tom Friedman, recently back from a weeks-long journey through India, in particular through high-tech India, India's shining, the corners of India that have snatched up jobs from around the world, and not just call centers, a lot of high-tech and right across the board that he's reporting on in a new documentary from there. Tom Friedman, we want to hear more from you about how India is absorbing these reforms and this hot, sizzling edge of the global economy. But I want to hear a voice first from your documentary work, a man, a novelist and scholar, Anantamurthy, that you spoke with there in India. Listen with me for just a second to his concerns about the impact of globalization, westernization, on his culture.
When these bonds disappear, we may have all the problems that the West has without some of the advantages that the West has.
How so?
In India, the family acts like a safety net, whereas in all the rich countries, it is the social security provided by the government. But that social security in India is from the family, sometimes even an extended family. And now it has gone so far, if you are wealthy enough, rich enough, you may send your parents to a old people's home, which I think is very sad.
Novelist Anantamurthy talking in India with Tom Friedman. Tom, give us a sense of, on balance, how Indians are viewing this. You've gone out and generously reported some of the people who have second thoughts about it. How representative is Anantamurthy's concern there about not wanting to become a carbon copy of the West?
Well, the best way I can answer that question, Tom, is just to pick up where I left off before the break, which is what is this Indian election telling us?
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing is what I think might be the new form of the anti-globalization movement. But it's very different from the Seattle form of the anti-globalization movement. See, I think what Indian voters were saying was not what the people in Seattle were saying. Stop the world. I want to get off.
These would be the ones you called a Noah's Ark of flat earth advocates, protectionist trade unions, and yuppies looking for their 60s fix.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think what the Indian voters were telling us was stop the world. I want to get on. What I mean by that was, and the reason they threw out both parties at the local level was because there is a feeling there that, yes, India may be shining, but it's only for a small, almost tiny segment of the population. But Indian voters are not saying, oh, I don't want to shine. You know, I'd like to live here in abject poverty in my village. What they're saying is, I'd like to be part of that too. I now see that world. It's right before my eyes. But the only way I can get a share of that world is if we have some decent government here, is if we have a government that can deliver education and water and resources and infrastructure for everybody. And that, to me, is the real message. And I'm here also drawing on my own Indian friends and their analysis. That is the real message from this election. And that is why the Congress Party, when they came in, didn't say, oh, I guess the people don't want any more globalization. Let's stop that. Just the opposite. They put their arch globalizer in, but with the mission to bring the benefits of this phenomena to a much wider cross-section of the Indian people. And the key to that is not putting internet in the house of every Indian, but decent government, getting rid of some of the corruption, and providing some basic infrastructure to all the millions of Indians that don't have it.
Tom, how much of India's enormous billion-plus population can globalization be expected to reach? What percentage of their population can look to globalization as a tide that might one day lift their boat? Is it always going to be an elite, the happy young men and women you talk to, shopping down the main street of Bangalore, sure, buying the latest jeans and shoes? Can it reach and touch a significant portion?
Well, it can if you consider that a big part of globalization is also agriculture. And remember that. And, you know, one of the greatest things we could do by way of globalization to help a massive number of Indians would be to end our ridiculous agriculture subsidies to our own farmers, $3 billion a year to 25,000 cotton farmers. That would have a huge impact. And so globalization isn't just about making microchips or working at call centers. Let's first of all remember that. But if you are talking about the high-tech end of globalization, we're talking about maximum, 2% of the population. I mean, to say that 20 million people directly or indirectly in India benefit from that would probably be generous. But they are an important model because, you know, I'm a big believer. Stan Fisher, the former deputy director of the IMF, like to say that one good example is worth 1,000 theories. And I do believe in that.
And is this a model that as India gets to know it well and across broader numbers, you feel it's going to want to embrace? There's a lot of change that's implicit here. You quote some resistors to that.
Absolutely.
You quote one guy, I just wanted to bring it to you, saying please, human beings are being reduced to consumers and losing their own cultural traditions.
And there's a real fear of that among many more older Indians we ran into, though, than young people. You know, my own feeling about India, one of the great strengths of Indian culture and the reason why I think India can be successful at globalization is that the key to being successful at globalization, I've always thought as a country or even as an individual, is actually depends on your ability to be good at glocalization. That is, taking the best that the global economy and modernity can offer your society and then melding it with your local culture. And you know, for all of the worries and complaints that people in India have about losing their culture, I find Indian culture very robust. That, you know, underneath the call centers and the IT and the microchips, Indians are still wearing saris, eating curry, and still living in extended families. That's a very robust culture, and it's their ability to glocalize. The Mughals come, the Mughals go, we take the best. You know, the British come, the British go, we take the best. But underneath, we're still Indians, and I find that they have a very robust culture.
Though at some level, globalization comes to state. There was a fascinating exchange. I just want to relate. You were talking with a panel of non-enthusiasts for globalization. Yeah. I don't remember the setting. And
yes, there it's
a very bright woman
center
there says is defending traditional Indian village life. And you, in a very Friedman-esque way, before she can complete her thought, anybody can do this, be guilty of this, but you say, you know, I'm sure you're all wrong. You over-idealize village life, you said to her, essentially.
Yes.
And her response to you, Tom Friedman, sir, you over-idealize the globalized life. You've been championing globalization for years now. Are there areas where you've become more enthusiastic than ever? Are there others where you've trimmed your sails and said, I don't know about that? Or is it we just take it whole hog?
Oh, you know, if I'm going to be honest, you know, about this, and if people are going to be honest about my position, because I was, you know, one of the first people to write about this subject in a very prominent way in Lexis and the Olive Tree, let's start, you know, there. People said, "Oh my God, you're the apostle of globalization. You're the prophet." I was called the prophet of globalization, and I found all this rather amusing, considering that a quarter of my book was about the backlash against globalization. It was also written, I will remind you, a year before Seattle. In other words, I've been keenly aware of the downside. But what did I do? I came along and said, "You know what? There's some good things here, and there's some bad things here." And people then say, shill for global capitalism. No, I'm just saying there's some good things here and then some spokesman for multinational corporations. No, I'm just saying there's some good things and we got to get the good and we got to cushion the bad. Spokesman for, you know, Daddy Warbucks.
No, we've got it. But in fairness, you've also said, folks, this is coming. This is going to be.
Well, there's a big difference, Tom, between saying this is coming. This is the world we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, because it is, I want to get the best out of it. And I think there are good things to be gotten out of it and cushion the worst, because I think there are bad aspects to it. The biggest chapter in Lexis and the Olive Tree was called Demolition Man. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between that and saying, you are the prophet, the apostle, the driver, the lover, of, the inventor. I'm, my God, where would all this be if I hadn't showed up with a book? You know?
Well, but okay, you've been surfing all over a big, big wave here. That's for sure.
Yeah, but so in fairness, you know, for people who actually read my book, it's a very nuanced argument. It says, here is what technology is doing. Here's the world it's creating. Here are the upsides. Here are the downsides. I believe there are upsides. I believe there are downsides. Let's get the best out of it and cushion the worst. And, you know, give me credit. I put, you know, I can edit my own documentary any way I want. I put that exchange with
Absolutely.
That woman, you know, in my own documentary, you know.
As we watched it, we realized it. But it made us want to ask, essentially, with the advantage.
But you didn't see the whole exchange, because what I also, and you can say that, you know, in her defense as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, where we go also from that, you know, she's idealizing village life. Village life in so many villages around Bangalore is wretched. It is wretched. There is nothing charming about people living with open sewers.
Cow dung fires.
Incredible spousal abuse, you know, alcoholism, corrupt local officials. There is nothing charming about this whatsoever. And for, you know, upper middle class, effete intellectuals with their cell phone in one pocket, smoking their cigarette, blowing smoke in my face and telling me how I'm some arch globalizer and I over-idealize globalization, they haven't spent one bloody second in a village, you know. And that's why we go from that, we cut from that encounter to a village where somebody who actually lives in a village and has to deal with untouchables is actually doing what it takes, what is required, and what is possible to lift them out of that misery. And what are they doing? They're using a lot of the tools of globalization.
And those quite incredible scenes where these little kids, maybe 7 years old, saying, what do you want to be? A physicist, a scientist,
it's
an
amazing.
Engineer, an astronaut, a physician, right on down the line.
And you know what none of them said? I want to live in a wretched village to be an authentic person for these effete intellectuals sitting around Delhi. That's what not one of them said.
All right, let's flip it around then. Here you have this 550 million Indians.
And if you want to know what I really think, watch this documentary.
We'll ask you to be candid.
Right.
Let's flip it. 555 million Indians under 26, a lot of ambition there. Their own questions about what it means for their culture. But meanwhile, back in the United States not so long ago, you're sitting with Craig Barrett, CEO of Intel, in Silicon Valley, and he's pouring out his concern that all of this competition is going to hit the United States like a ton of bricks that the country is not ready for and is not preparing for. How does the United States dance with a new or a reviving partner like India and succeed?
Well, Tom, you've raised the $64,000 question of the 21st century. And because I think that is the question, I'll share with you and your listeners that I'm actually going on sabbatical July 1st to write a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's that important. And the book is called The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. And the basic theme of the book is that Christopher Columbus in 1492 set sail actually looking for a shorter route to India.
Yeah.
He had the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria, and he didn't find India. He found America, but he called the people there. He found Indians anyways. And when he came home, he said, honey, I didn't find India, but I accidentally discovered the world is round. I actually set off for India. I knew just where I was going. I was flying on Lufthansa business class via Frankfurt. I came home and reported to my wife, honey, I've accidentally discovered the world is flat.
And by that, you mean?
I mean that the playing field is being leveled. And because of the technologies that have really converged here at the beginning of the 21st century, Indians sitting in Bangalore can compete head to head with American accountants, radiologists, call center workers, software designers, engineers. And at the same time, they're deeply motivated, they're hungry, they're well-educated, they speak English. And this challenge, this competition, is going to be something that's going to increasingly, I think, shape our world. I think it has a chance to shape it in a positive way. It's more people creating, you know, connecting more knowledge pools around the world to do more innovation and hopefully to create more profit and rising standards of living around the world. But it's going to be a rocky transition. It's going to be a bear. And because I want to understand it better, because I think it's so important, and because I think it's actually the biggest thing that's been happening while we were sleeping, which is to say while we've been engaged in the war on terrorism. Mm-hmm. And that's really what Craig Barrett of Intel and I were talking about. Mm-hmm. I want to get ahead of it, and that's what I'm doing.
Tom, the United States has not lived much in a flat world. It had huge advantages of natural resources. It had huge advantages of the rest of the world being flattened by war when it was not. But presumably it comes into this flatter world you describe with a lot of advantages. But is it acting in a way to protect those right now, to take fullest advantage of those?
Well, that's really, again, what Craig Barrett of Intel was arguing. You know, if you look at the statistics, don't hold me to these are round numbers, but roughly 65 to 70% of all college grads in China graduate with either engineering or science degrees. In India, it's a little lower than that. It's somewhere between 50 and 60%. In America, it's around 20%. Now, we just can't keep doing that year after year at the same time that we're closing our borders because of 9/11, so we're not creaming off those intellectual first-round draft choices from around the world and bringing them to our shores. We cannot stay on this trend and expect to stay competitive in a world where the playing field is being leveled. Over time, it really is going to take a toll. And that's why we need to have a serious discussion if this campaign were about serious things other than the war on terrorism, not just about who's stronger and who has the bigger muscles, you know. Mm-hmm. It would be about this issue of competitiveness. What do we need to do by way of taxes? What do we need to do by way of education? What do we need to do by way of government investment in just basic science and math research? You know, think about Google, Tom. What is, you know, Google, I mean, Sergey Brin and, you know, Larry Page, they're mathematicians. Google's just an algorithm. I mean, that's what it's based on. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of stuff is what is spun off by just basic research. We should be pouring money into that. And the fact that we have an administration that really doesn't talk about these things at all and doesn't even have the courage to let its own chief economic advisor even make the argument for outsourcing. You know, he tried that once, and I think they taped his mouth shut with duct tape. And he's tied up somewhere in the basement or maybe living with Dick Cheney, wherever he's living. And, you know, that's, I think, a really bad thing. It's not going to hit us this year or next year or the year after. But in 10, 12, 15 years, we will feel it.
Why is the United States in that case, Tom, having such a hard time coming to grips with this new reality, if that's indeed what we're facing here? Americans are supposed to be hard-nosed pragmatists.
Well, you know, I think if you look at the corporate level, I've spent a lot of time in writing this book. You talk to people, you know, like folks at IBM. What you look at what people in the corporate world are doing, they get it entirely, and they're just kind of doing it because they live in a Darwinian competitive environment.
But they're global, and they're globalizing, and they're not necessarily national corporations anymore.
No,
they may not
absolutely
help the homeland.
And that's one of the things I'm saying, you know. And, you know, Intel just opened a big new factory where? In China, you know, not in Indianapolis. And so so companies, you know, at the kind of the company level getting it. But the contrast, it's always just stunning to me, Tom, when you go to visit a company like IBM and you talk to executives there about what they're doing. And these are primarily Americans, you know.
Yeah.
And they're really bright. They're really smart. They're really at the cutting edge. And the contrast kind of between the discussion you have there and the discussion we're having on the national level, it's just really depressing. You know, it's really, really depressing.
That has got to be turned around. Tom Friedman says the sooner the better. He's been reporting from India. He's always looking at the United States. He's also been paying attention to the war on terrorism, the war in Iraq. We'll come back after a short break and speak about that. My guest, Tom Friedman of the New York Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest tonight, Tom Friedman, columnist for The New York Times. His new documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, premieres on the Discovery Channel tomorrow night. We've been looking with Tom Friedman at India and all that's going on there, its impact on the United States, its challenge to the United States in the century ahead. Tom Friedman, I want to turn now, if we could, to the war in Iraq. So much going on in recent days. You've written about it a lot. You supported going in. You've lamented the way the war has been executed. When you look out right now with this new interim government named, with Ahmed Chalabi alleged to have tipped the Iranians off that the United States has broken their high intelligence code, with everything going on, what's your assessment? Are we making headway here or falling back?
Well, you framed the question and you framed my position very accurately, Tom. And I think the challenge now here is to kind of see through all of this, both noise and smoke and real violence, to where are we? And Lord knows, this administration has really done such a poor job in planning and prosecuting this war. But it all reminds me of when you ask about this moment of the guy who gets lost and goes to a policeman and asks directions. You know, he says, you know, how do I get to Tom Ashbrook's studio?
Place,
And the policeman says, well, you wouldn't start from here. Well, Tom, you wouldn't start from here.
But here we are, my friend.
But here's where we are. So I'm going to give you the best answer I can on here. From here is where we are. This new Iraqi government, formed with the cooperation and the blessing of the UN, I happen to know several of the people in this government, and this is not a bad government. This is a – given the clay we had to work with, given the options, but also just given the players, this is not a bad group of people. I have no idea whether they will be able to succeed. They don't know. This is the first time in Iraq's history that the people, as it were, even a an appointed group like this by the UN and Americans, will be handed the keys. No Iraqi can tell you how they will do, because they don't know. They've never been here before. And all I can say is I'm hopeful, by no means, I'm not going to say optimistic, let alone certain, but I'm still hopeful that they can eventually get their arms around the security situation. And it's going to be two steps forward, one step back. Democracy building has always been a process of trial and error. But from where we are now with this government, it's still conceivable that we can get to what, for me, was always the important outcome. And as you know, because we talked about it before, I never believed in WMD, that was not the reason to go to war. I never believed Saddam had anything that threatened us. I believed this was about trying to tilt a country that was tilted in the wrong direction to tilt it in the right direction, in hopes of tilting the wider region over time in the right direction. I still think that's possible. It's going to be difficult. There'll be many ups and downs. But what I really don't understand is why everyone now is bailing out. I mean, I've got nowhere to go. I argued this could be the right war. It had to be done the right way. They didn't do it the right way. I've tried to use my column and my voice to point it in the right direction. But I think the stakes are so big, and I've always felt the stakes are so big for the world we live in, for the Middle East and the world my kids, that I was not going to bail out. I did not want to use my voice to be a voice of cynicism. I had my criticisms from the beginning, but I still am going to be in there pitching till the fat lady sings. She hasn't sung yet, and I don't understand why this is national I give up on Iraq week right when we finally have this government. It may fall apart. The whole thing may go to the dogs. It's not there yet, and as long as it isn't, I am going to use my voice to do everything I can to tilted in the right direction.
And we hear that and we read it. It raises a lot of questions and stuff. But one thing I want to ask you about is accountability. We talked about your own accountability last time, and we understand where you are on that. But what about the U.S. government accountability? Given, in some ways, I'm hearing a slightly lowered goal here. A tilt is a little different than an accomplished state of being, but fair enough. But if by November you see Iraq tilting adequately by your lights to justify all that's gone on, and that's saying a lot given your condemnation of a lot that's gone on.
Right.
Let's talk about fireable offenses for where we are or where we are not. Does the Bush administration, does the Pentagon, if we can leave politics out of it for a moment, just look at execution. Do they deserve to stay in office? Do they deserve to stay in their roles given the job that's been done in Iraq, Tom Friedman?
Well, I did a column, 2 weeks ago on just this point, in which I said that I believe Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld should be fired, primarily, in my view, for the incredibly poor planning and execution of this war in the face of so many people writing at the time and advocating different policies. And I'm not talking now about columnists. I'm talking about Army Chief of Staff, you know, level people. And so I believe, you know, Rumsfeld should be fired. I believe their performance, the Pentagon's in the war, has been one of gross incompetence and negligence. It'll be up for the American people to decide whether they want to fire the president. And I'm just not going to get into that right now. We're not allowed to endorse or not endorse.
Never mind endorsing if Iraq ends up tilting in a direction you like. Can George Bush rightly take credit for that? He's the guy who took us into this war. Can he claim the credit this fall if Iraq is tilting in a way that Tom Friedman says looks not bad?
Absolutely, he can claim credit for it. I have no problem with that, just as I would have no problem calling for Rumsfeld to be fired on the other side. I approach this war, Tom, as you know, because we talked about it, with the following view. This is so important. This issue, not Iraq, you know, in miniature, but the whole question of where the Arab-Muslim world is going, okay, today, and the fact that it is producing undeterrable young men, people who hate us more than they love life, that dealing with that issue, which I think is a fundamental threat to open societies, because when people take instruments from our daily life, the airplane, the tennis shoe, the car, and turn them into suicide weapons, what you do is take the trust out of open societies, and that is lethal for an open society. I believe that tilting that part of the world in a different direction was so important, it had to be approached in a nonpartisan way, and that's how I approached it. I had two mantras going into this war, as you know, because we talked about them. One is that some things are true, even if George Bush believes them. It took me a long time to get my mind around that, but that is a fact. And the other thing that was true, and it was my message to conservatives, was that just because you have a hammer, not every problem is a nail, and that you have to deal with the war on terrorism with a multi-pronged policy, one involving energy, development, Arab-Israeli diplomacy. They didn't do that, but as we said, this is where we are. There's still a chance we can come out with something tilted in a decent direction, and that would be a big deal. And I don't care who gets credit for it if that happens.
Well, carrots and sticks from the lips of Tom Friedman. Tom, great to speak with you as always. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tom Friedman's documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, premieres on the Discovery Channel tomorrow night. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a look at President Bush's latest foreign policy address delivered earlier today at the Air Force Academy. This is On Point. Facing poll numbers that show a strong majority of Americans disapprove of his handling of the Iraq War, President Bush defended his foreign policy again today, comparing the war on terror to the Cold War and World War II. In some ways, this struggle we're in is unique, Bush told graduates of the Air Force Academy. In other ways, it resembles the great clashes of the last century between those who put their trust in tyrants and those who put their trust in liberty. Last night, we brought you Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry's latest foreign policy speech. Tonight, an excerpt from President Bush's commencement address at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado, from earlier today.
Above all, America will need perseverance. This conflict will take many turns, with setbacks on the course to victory. Through it all, our confidence comes from one unshakable belief. We believe, in Ronald Reagan's words, that the future belongs to the free. And we've seen the appeal of liberty with our own eyes. We've seen freedom firmly established in former enemies like Japan and Germany. We've seen freedom arrive on waves of unstoppable progress to nations in Latin America and Asia and Africa and Eastern Europe. Now freedom is stirring in the Middle East, and no one should bet against it. In the years immediately after World War II ended, our nation faced more adversity and danger with the rise of imperial communism. In 1947, communist forces were pressing a civil war in Greece and threatening Turkey. More than 2 years after the Nazi surrender, there was still starvation in Germany. Reconstruction seemed to be faltering, and the Marshall Plan had not yet begun. In 1948, Berlin was blockaded on the orders of Joseph Stalin. In 1949, the Soviet Union exploded a nuclear weapon, and communists in China won their revolution. All this took place in the first 4 years of the Cold War. If that generation of Americans had lost its nerve, there would have been no long twilight struggle, only a long twilight. But the United States and our allies kept faith with captive peoples and stayed true to the vision of a democratic Europe. And that perseverance gave all the world a lesson in the power of liberty. We are now about 3 years into the war against terrorism. We have overcome great challenges. We face many today, and there are more ahead. This is no time for impatience and self-defeating pessimism. These times demand the kind of courage and confidence that Americans have shown before.
President Bush delivering today's commencement address at the Air Force Academy. I'm joined now by John Harwood, National Political Editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
What do you hear in the president's remarks in Colorado Springs today, John?
Well, both in his remarks yesterday and today, I hear rising confidence from the president that he's about to turn a corner politically on Iraq. The announcement of the new interim government and the press for a new United Nations resolution as the president heads overseas to meet with U.S. allies overseas suggests, I think, to the president and his team that they're getting to a different place in Iraq, a place where they can reach out for international support the way John Kerry and others have asked him to, and begin to shed the American face on this occupation, which they will see as an unequivocal step forward. We saw today he was casting the aims of his administration as part of the long line of the American struggle for freedom that his father, Ronald Reagan, but other Democratic presidents, Harry Truman and FDR, pursued.
All the way back to starvation in Germany after the fall of the Nazis, the Berlin blockade, Soviet nukes, the communist Chinese victory, saying they didn't lose their nerve, we can't either, it's no time for self-defeating pessimism. Do these sound to you, John, like political lines that will resonate?
Well, this is a president who has benefited consistently from the belief that he states clear goals and that he's resolute and strong in pursuing them. He's clearly he's made some adjustments on Iraq. He's in fact moved closer to John Kerry by looking for more international support. But nevertheless, he has argued to the American people to stay the course behind this effort to construct a democracy in the Middle East. Many in his own party worry that it's not realistic, but he continues to advocate it. He did today in this speech, and that is going to strike a chord with Americans who say he's at least taking a consistent direction.
Tapping some very deep themes here, and I guess with that, strapping his reelection chances, as if they were not already strapped, to events on the ground in Iraq. If they continue to look hopeful, it resonates well with these themes. If they do not, he could look very unrealistic.
Well, exactly. And if we see continued violence, he's tried to warn that we will see an uptick in violence around the June 30th, immediately after that transition, and maybe in the run-up to the election this fall. But if he can essentially create a picture of greater order, that we're moving toward elections in 2005, that it looks like we're going someplace and not just stuck in the mud with American soldiers as sort of providing target practice for insurgents, then he can begin to make the argument that our policy is paying off and focus on the improving economy, which is a strength of his, which isn't getting much attention right now.
And maybe with those themes, leave less maneuvering room for John Kerry, the president, feeling his oats again today in Colorado Springs. John Harwood, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.